Okay, so I want to thank the organizers for this meeting. It's been very stimulating so far. I'm going to talk about something that's different. I'm going to talk about massively parallel computing using graphical processing units. And I'm going to introduce two problems that I've worked on recently in spatial Bayesian image modeling that were very computationally intense and I've been able to achieve a couple orders of magnitude and increase in computation speed using graphical processing units. And I thought a workshop in high-dimensional data would be a great place to talk about this. So I'm going to introduce the two models first, and then I'll talk a little bit about GPU computing. Can't do too much on this in a half an hour. I'll show the results and then just give some concluding remarks. But before I go on, massively parallel computing on GPUs is here now. R is starting to support it. SAS is, I just found out about 2 hours ago. MATLAB has a toolbox for using GPUs as well as Mathematica. So the first problem was a group fMRI analysis, and it was a hierarchical Bayesian model that was published a couple years ago in Biometrics. The most computationally intense part of this whole algorithm was computing the likelihood. Typically, you have about 10 to 20 subjects, and so the likelihood, we're assuming these subjects are independent, so the likelihood is independent for each of the subjects. And we model the image intensities with a finite mixture model, and the weights are spatially correlated. It can take several components to model each activation region. So in fMRI, you look for activation regions or parts of the brain where the blood oxygen level dependent signal increases above baseline. So these activation regions aren't always normally distributed, so they have some weird shapes, so it can take several components to model each activation region. And the component means are further modeled as a finite mixture about activation centers. And then we have two other levels where for each individual, these activation centers are finite mixtures about population centers. So this is where we bring all the subjects together into a group level model. And at level three, the population centers are modeled as a homogeneous Poisson process. And I'm just going to concentrate on level one. So just a little notation. Y sub V is going to be the intensity at voxel V. And for each subject, there's about 250,000 voxels in the brain. The size of a voxel is about 2 millimeters on a side, so it's about 8 cubic millimeters. X sub V is just going to indicate the spatial location or the XYZ location of voxel V. And phi is going to denote the Gaussian density with mean m and variance v. So all voxels are assumed to be conditionally independent within a subject, given the weights and the mixture model. Okay. So the number of mixture components, which is j plus 1, is unknown. I used reversible jump MCMC. The number of components depends on the subject and how alert they are, how active they are. It could be anywhere from 10 to 15 up to over 100 mixture components. The weights, Y0, this is the baseline component. So if nothing changes in particular regions of the brain, we assume that the intensity is normal with mean 0 and variance 1. We do put priors on these in the paper, but for here, just assume it's normal 0, 1. With the weight W, that's proportional to some constant M, and it doesn't matter what that is for this particular talk. The other weights, WJ, have this mixture model as well. So WJ is proportional to a 3D Gaussian density in R3 at X with mean vector eta J and covariance matrix CJ. And this is very computationally intense because each time you want to, at each iteration, if you want to update the components of a parameter of one of these weights, eta J or CJ, you have to compute the likelihood ratio at each voxel in the brain for that subject. So this is a very computationally intense likelihood to compute. The second problem is I was modeling multiple sclerosis lesion locations in 217 subjects. For this, I'm going to introduce a little bit more notation and definition. So I'm going to be using a log Gaussian Cox process. And I'm going to assume that Y is some non-negative random field. With probability 1, this non-negative random field is locally integrable. And then if a point process X conditional on this non-negative random field is a Poisson process on the space S with intensity y, then x is said to be a Cox process driven by the intensity function y. For some subset B in this space S, x intersect B has this density. It doesn't have a typical density with respect to Lebesgue measure. It has a rate on nicotine derivative with respect to a unit rate Poisson process, and it's given by this expectation. And the intensity function of the Cox process is just given by the expected value, expectation of this non-negative random field y. Okay? If this non-negative random, if y is a Gaussian process, then the non-negative random field e to the y, it's a Cox process driven by y, then this is a log Gaussian Cox process. The distribution of the process in this field y is completely determined by the expectation of y and the correlation matrix, or the correlation function, I'm sorry. In this particular case, I'm going to assume that the correlation function is translation invariant and isotropic. And I'm going to use a particular form where I pull out the marginal variance sigma squared and have the correlation function, which is just a function of distance that makes it isotropic. A useful family of correlation functions for these models is the power exponential family, so the correlation function is just given by this form. If delta is 1, you have exponential decay. If delta is 2, you have a Gaussian decay in the correlation. Okay, so in my problem, I'm going to model the multiple sclerosis lesions, or the locations of them, for 217 subjects. The intensity function I'm going to use is this log Gaussian intensity function. So y is a Gaussian process on the brain in R3. And the mean of the process is mu, and I'm going to use the stationary correlation function, where both rho and sigma are estimated with what Muller and Wagner-Peterson call the minimum contrast estimate. It's just basically a non-parametric estimate of the correlation function. Okay? Now, in this particular case, the brain is going to be discretized on a grid. Remember, these correlation functions are continuous functions, so they're infinite dimensional. So we need to discretize the brain on a grid, and in this case, it's 91 by 109 by 91. And then our intensity function is going to be, or the Gaussian process will be approximated by a finite dimensional Gaussian random variable y tilde. Okay? So the length of this, if we take this Gaussian process and make it a vector, the length of this thing is about 900,000 long. For computational purposes, I want to compute y tilde and e to the y tilde. I want the intensity function of this process. We can rewrite y tilde as the mean plus sigma. I've pulled out the sigma squared from the correlation function. C to the 1/2 z, where z is a multivariate normal distribution with covariance, an identity covariance matrix. So for this problem, the covariance matrix is 902,000 by 902,000. Trying to get C to the 1/2 on this would be a daunting task. Obviously, it's too large to really handle computationally. So problems like this have been partially solved using what I'm going to talk about now. So these correlation matrices, they turn out to be toplets in structure. If our problem's 1D, block toplets. If we have a 2D structure, and if it's a 3D, like the brain imaging, we have this nested block toplet structure for the correlation matrix. And Wood and Chan gave a quick way to actually compute these matrices and inverses of these matrices by embedding these toplets matrices into circulant, block circulant, or nested block circulant matrices. So we're actually expanding the size of these matrices. I'm going to call the circulant matrix capital C. And for circulant matrices, they're completely specified by a single row. If you know one row, you know all the rows of the circulant matrix. That's called the base. I'll call it little c. And I'm going to let f lambda f hat denote the eigenvector eigenvalue decomposition of this circulant matrix. Okay. Now, since at least the 70s, it's been known that there is a relationship between the eigenvalue eigenvector decomposition of circulant matrices and the discrete Fourier transform matrix. Okay, so F is the discrete Fourier transform matrix, and lambda just turns out to be a diagonal matrix with FC as a vector. Put that along the diagonal and the square root of n. Okay. In order to take these Toeplitz matrices and make them circulant, you need to a little less than double the size of each dimension of the original problem. So now the base of this circulant matrix is of size 7,221,000. But since we have this relationship between circulant matrices and the discrete Fourier transform, we can use the fast Fourier transform. For any vector v, f times v, we can compute by taking the discrete Fourier transform of v. And fh, this is the Hermitian matrix of f, or the complex conjugate transformation of f times v, is just the inverse discrete Fourier transform. Okay, so we can use the FFT, and the FFT, the computational complexity of this is n log base 2n. Okay, so it seems kind of counterintuitive that we've made this, taken our covariance matrix and in 3D case made it 8 times larger, but it actually makes things more computationally efficient. Yes? Okay. I'm sorry?
I think you are trying to find the location of the lesion, location of certain disease.
No, I'm just assuming that the lesions in a person's brain are a realization of a point process. And I want to estimate the intensity function. The intensity function is what drives the location of the points.
Okay, so they are somewhat related.
Yeah. Maybe we can talk about it later. Okay, yeah. So we can do this extremely fast since we have a fast Fourier transform. But the length of this base is 7 million long. So even with the FFT, and I used a package called FFTW, which is freely available on the web, to compute c to the 1/2 z here, takes about a second per iteration. So if you're going to do a couple hundred thousand iterations in a Bayesian framework, you can see it takes a long time to do these computations. So for example, we need to compute something like this, c to the 1/2 v, and we can easily write this down in terms of inverse and discrete Fourier transforms. And so this whole operation is still an order n log base 2n. Or we can invert and solve for x here, x equals c inverse b, by just taking a few discrete and inverse discrete Fourier transforms. Dot here means it's the element-wise product of these two vectors, and this symbol means it's the element-wise division of the two vectors. Okay? And you can, I have that paper Wood and Shannon. Also, Held and Rue have a book on Gaussian Markov random fields, which has a nice section about this whole relationship between circulant matrices and the discrete Fourier transform. So overall, the MCMC algorithm is quite slow. All right, let's talk a little bit about GPU computing. GPUs are very good at doing massively parallel computing. Okay, a lot of the development of GPUs was based because of people who like to play games on computers with these nice fancy graphics. But about 4 or 5 years ago, some engineers realized that these can be used to do massively parallel computing as well. And so NVIDIA and another company, AMD Radeon, have been developing GPUs for general purpose graphical process unit computing. This first graph shows about in January 2003 through December 2009, the light blue and the dark blue graphs are the most powerful Intel processors and their theoretical gigaflops per second they can achieve single and double precision. Okay? In the 90s, these things used to grow exponentially. Well, they're not anymore. They're growing very slow. Okay? With GPUs, this dark green is the card, NVIDIA card Tesla C2050. Double precision, it can achieve about over 500 gigaflops per second theoretical speed. And the GeForce GTX 580, single precision, can get 1500 gigaflops per second. I have this Tesla C2050, and it can achieve over 1 teraflop per second calculations, theoretically. And the newest card that NVIDIA just came out with last month can achieve 1.33 teraflops per second, single precision. So how do GPUs achieve such stunning performance gain over CPUs? Well, this little cartoon of a CPU and GPU shows that for a CPU, both CPUs and GPUs have thousands of transistors on the chips. The CPU dedicates a lot of it to caching and to control, flow control, and very little to the arithmetic logic units, whereas a GPU takes a different stand and it has very little cache, very little control, but it uses a lot of transistors for doing the calculations themselves. So more transistors are dedicated to data processing rather than data caching and control flow. And GPUs typically have hundreds of cores. This Tesla C2050 has 448. A lot of the GeForce cards that you'd get for gaming will have 256 or so cores. My MacBook Pro laptop has two GPUs in it. One has 16 cores and one has 32. So even laptops, you can get performance gains using GPU computing. One of the keys to GPU computing is that there's memory bandwidth limitations. So over here on this side, you'd have your host or your computer, and typically you'll have, you know, 8, 16, maybe even 32 or 64 gigabytes of memory. On the GPU card, there's DRAM within the device, and this will have anywhere from, now the cards have 1 gigabyte up to 6 gigabytes of DRAM. It's broken up into different types of memory. And then on each multiprocessor within the GPU, there are registers and shared memory. Okay, so, and here you only have the registers have about 64K of memory, or the registers have 16 to 32K memory, and shared memory is about 64K, so it's very small. So going from right to left, you have more memory, but the data transfer speeds are much faster as you go from left to right. So going from the host memory to the device memory is quite slow. Going from local or global memory to the register shared memory is a little bit faster, but the memory here resides right on the processors, and so it's almost instantaneous. Okay, so how is the GPU exposed in C or C++ or Fortran or MATLAB? There's two C++ interfaces that are commonly used. CUDA is specific for NVIDIA cards. 10 minutes? Okay, no problem. And OpenCL is a can be written, and it can be used for any GPU card or even CPUs that are OpenCL compliant. But the basic thing is that there are special malloc functions to allocate memory on the GPU. Once you allocate that memory, you need to get your data from the CPU to GPU, and there's special copy functions for that. And then we call a kernel function, which is executed on the GPU, and this is what's run in parallel on your data. Then we need to copy any output we have from the kernel function back from the GPU to the CPU, and there's special C interface functions for that as well. So it's pretty easy to get up to speed and to do this. I learned how to do this and programmed both of these in about 3 weeks, and I got fairly good performance. And then you need the free GPU memory. Okay, what are these kernel functions? They're just C functions with a little bit of extra notation. They're executed on the GPU in parallel by what are called threads. And these threads are called just the smallest functional unit. Each thread executes the kernel on a separate piece of data, and it does it all lockstep in parallel. Okay? Each thread has its own register memory for looping variables and such, and these register memories are invisible to the other threads. Threads are further partitioned into blocks. You can have up to 1,024 threads per block. Threads within a block can cooperate with one another, and they can share memory. So if you know that all threads in a block are going to use the same amount of memory, copy that from global to the shared memory, and you only have to copy it once instead of 1,024 times. And then threads between blocks don't cooperate. And then the coarsest level of refinement are the grids, and they're just blocks of threads partitioned into grids. So usually for one kernel, you'll have one grid, and a grid can have 64K by 64K by 64K blocks. It can be a three-dimensional grid. Each block can have 1024 threads, so a grid can have a lot of data in it. And the host interface calls the kernel. When we call this kernel, we need to specify the number of threads per block we want to run and the number of blocks per grid, and then just pass memory pointers to the data that we've loaded on the GPU, and that's it. Other than that, it's just C programming. So this is a two-dimensional version of a grid. So there's 2D blocks broken up into two rows and three columns. The blocks each have their own specific X and Y coordinate ID. And then within each block, the threads are run in parallel on different pieces of the data. Okay, so for a simple dumbed-down example, for the fMRI group data, for example, I need to loop over all my voxels, about 250,000 of them. Within each voxel, if I want to compute the jth mixture component contribution to the likelihood of voxel A, voxel I, I need to loop over all these mixture components. Okay? If there's 100 mixture components and 250,000 voxels, that's this double loop. You have to do it 25 million times. It's very computationally intense. The parallel code looks kind of similar. We allocate GPU memory, data copy from CPU to GPU, call our kernel, data copy back from GPU to CPU, and then free the memory. And the kernel looks almost like this inner loop. And in fact, you can just do this inner loop. You don't get as good a performance. If you notice that each mixture component, the parameters in that, you can load those into shared memory and let all the threads share that memory within a block, and it makes it much faster. And then you just end the mixture loop. So what about gains in computational efficiency? I ran both models using a CPU and then combination of GPU and CPU calculations. For the group fMRI, I ran them for 5,000 iterations each. Since there's not a lot of memory on these GPUs, that's always a concern, but this only took 175 megabytes of GPU memory. It took, on CPU alone, about 230 hours of CPU time, whereas on the GPU, it took 1.2 hours. That's a factor of 191 times. Okay, so from days to about an hour. The LGCP, I got similar results. Both of these I ran for 120,000 iterations. The memory on the GPU was 311 megabytes. And it went from 595 hours down to 4.75 hours, or an increase in computation speed of 125. There are a few caveats with GPU computing. Nothing is for free. GPUs cost money, first off, but if you want the production line GPU that's for gaming, anywhere from $250 to $750. The high-end GPUs that are dedicated for parallel process computing are about $2,500. You want to reduce data transfers. So you want to put as much data as you can on the GPU once and leave it there. You don't want to be taking huge vectors and moving them back and forth between the CPU and GPU. You need to be careful with conditional branching, like if-else statements, because I didn't say it, but there are these threads are also broken up into hardware constraints called a warp of 32 threads. And if any one of the threads in a warp do a different, like if 31 of these do the if statement and the other one does an else statement, it serializes those processes. Okay? So you don't want many branching statements. And then there's something called bank conflicts. For shared memory between threads in a block, a bank conflict can occur when two or more threads within a warp try to access different bytes of memory within the same memory bank. It serializes these operations then. Okay. But if two or more threads try to access the same byte, no bank conflict occurs. So we might need to pad the arrays with zeros and make the array larger than it actually is so we don't get these bank conflicts. I've been lucky. I haven't run into many bank conflicts in my problems. But this is the most difficult aspect of the graphical processing unit computing. So my conclusions are just that these general-purpose graphical processing unit computing can substantially improve performance on many problems, not only Bayesian problems, but likelihood-based approaches. When Peter was just talking a minute ago, or somebody, I forgot who it was, they said something about permutation tests. Permutation tests, bootstrap, things like that would be perfect for GPU computing. And in general, the larger the problem, the greater your practical gains tend to be. So that's it. Thanks.